Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is Brian Kaplan, a professor of economics at George Mason University and a blogger for EconLog. Professor Kaplan is the author of multiple books, including two he and I have previously discussed on the show. That would be The Myth of the Rational Voter and The Case Against Education. Today we'll be discussing his latest book, Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. Brian Kaplan, welcome back.
Awesome to be here, Michael.
You know, we're going to talk a lot of almost exclusively about the content of the book. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about the format, which is a big departure for you. So maybe you could talk a little bit about why you decided to go with the graphic format for Open Borders.
Yes, this book is what is called a nonfiction graphic novel. Just to understand that, so there are movies. Most movies are fiction, but there are also some nonfiction ones we call documentaries. And this book is a documentary comic book. This does not mean that the quality of the ideas is low or that it's poorly documented. I tried to make the standards really high, but it does mean that I'm trying to combine words and pictures in order to communicate more information in a shorter amount of time. And my view is that it works. Now, I cannot draw myself, so I searched around for a collaborator, and I was able to get my number one choice in the world, and that was Zach Wienersmith, who does the webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. So I did about 95% of the words, but he added a few jokes and did some edits, and then I gave him full storyboards for how the book should look. I used Google Images to give him an idea of what I had in mind, and then we would go back and forth where he would draw a rough draft, and I'd give comments and so on, and the final result is the product that you see.
Yeah, and I remember when we were talking about this as your upcoming project, and you told me what you were going to be doing, and I thought, oh, I don't know about that. And so I was a skeptic, but you have won me over. It was a great experience reading it, and I really enjoyed the format.
I'm really glad to hear that. So I would say that I was really inspired by this 5-volume Cartoon History of the Universe series by Larry Gonick. And it really does just what it says. It starts with the Big Bang and ends with the Iraq War. And he's very careful. So any area of history that I knew well, I said he got all his facts right, at least up until the mid-19th century. and at the same time, by combining words and pictures, he just made it more vivid, more memorable. And there are a number of areas of history where I really had read it many times before, but it never stuck. And I thought after reading his nonfiction graphic novel series, I had better retention. So I mean, I remember reading his books and saying, these should be the textbooks that every American kid is reading for history. And I wanted to do something similar for economics. There's a few other economists who tried, but I thought that they didn't immerse themselves nearly as much in the vocabulary and grammar of comics as I did. And I'll also say, I don't think they got artists that are as good as mine.
Well, I felt a very similar experience. I mean, I felt that there were things that I came away from reading it, learning that I hadn't expected to, because I felt like I had a pretty good background in immigration policy, but I learned a lot and it was an enjoyable experience. And so let's get to some of that substance. And you opened the book talking about global prosperity. It's been obviously a great success story in recent decades. But as you also point out, there are these major gaps between rich and poor countries, rich and poor regions. And so a lot of people say, well, why don't more people just move? And a standard answer to that is, well, people mostly don't want to move. They have some kind of pride in their country, their heritage, and they want to stay put for the most part. Now, is that right?
Right. So it may be that most people don't want to move, but if you multiply a large minority by the global population of poor countries, we're still talking at least 1 billion people. So there have been some surveys that have tried to go and get every country on Earth and get an idea. And usually they come away with over 1 billion people want to at least leave their country for some years to make some money and maybe move permanently. So, yeah, that just seems to be basically wrong to think that a lot of people don't want to move. A lot of people do want to move, and that's in at least over 1 billion people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people for sure. And you say, and this statement really struck me. You said, we live in a world of global apartheid. I thought, whoa. So why don't you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, so there are many bad things about South African apartheid, but the most distinctive feature was that within the country of South Africa, there were a lot of places where blacks are not allowed to live, and there's a lot of jobs that they're not allowed to do. Right, so I see that the really distinctive feature of South African apartheid are these mobility restrictions where you're limiting where people can live and work. And essentially, this is what we have at the international level, where there's a lot of people around the world that would like to live and work in different countries than the ones they're born, but it's illegal, right? So there is a whole set of regulations in place to deliberately keep the world's populations apart. And in both cases, we should expect the same kind of economic effects, namely that you are trapping human talent in undesirable areas and undesirable occupations. And this then impoverishes not only the person that's affected by the laws, you're also impoverishing all the people that would have been the customers of them if they had been allowed to migrate.
And that, like I said, when I first encountered that, I thought, wow, that's a very, that's sort of a, sounds like a normative type of a statement. I thought, but then you went to back it up with not just with economic arguments, many of which I was familiar with, but you make an ethical argument. In fact, you argue in the book that there's a moral presumption in favor of immigration. And that was, I thought that was very interesting. And you illustrate it in a number of ways, but I think the best way, at least my favorite way, is through something called the Starving Marvin argument. And I was hoping you could explain that.
Yeah, so this is something that I get out of Michael Humer, although he stole the character name from South Park, I believe. But anyway, it comes down to there is a guy named Marvin who is stuck in a desolate part of the world, and he's going to starve to death. And then he says, hey, I got an idea. I'll move to another place, and I'll get a job, and I'll buy food, and I will live. And then he meets someone named Sam along the way who says, sorry, this is our area. You've got to get out. And Marvin says, well, how is it your area? The store wants me here. Employer wants me here. There's a landlord wants me here. So why are we even having this conversation? Just leave me alone. And Sam says, no, this is our collective property. We own all of this here. So we are being refused. And then there's the question of who's morally in the right here, right? And especially if Sam has to go, or rather if Marvin has to go back home and starve to death, was this comparable to killing him given that there was, or comparable to murder, given that he actually could have, if he were just left alone, found trading partners that would have allowed him to not only save his life, but make a better life for himself.
And so essentially, the argument is that the restrictions that the United States has on immigration don't just have economic costs, which we'll get to, but they also have very real costs in terms of human suffering and even death. And a point you make in the book is that it hasn't always been this way. The United States hasn't always been as restrictive on immigration as it currently is, correct?
Yeah, in fact, it used to be almost genuinely open borders. There were exceptions for China and Japan and a few other things like prostitutes. But up until 1921, the U.S. was very close to being an open borders country. And the interesting thing to me is that almost no one, no matter how critical they are of immigration, wants to say that that was a bad policy before. So almost everyone, even people that are professional immigration restrictionists, will say, well, sure, that kind of immigration was good. That built this country. And then often they'll say, but then when they changed the law, that was a good idea. But almost no one wants to defend the idea that it was a big mistake all along and the U.S. should have had the immigration policy they favor now since from the beginning. Right. And by the way, so when you're thinking about the moral equivalence of immigration restrictions and apartheid, I often like to actually imagine what would have been like to have had a conversation with a defender of South African apartheid back when they had it. And if you were to say, look, how can you go and treat black South Africans this way? I think a common reaction would be to say, well, we don't consider them citizens of this country. right? They're, you know, we allow them to be here, but the citizens are the white, are the whites here, and the others are simply guests. And if you were to say, no, but you know, they're fellow South Africans, it's wrong. They just say, no, we keep telling you they're not fellow South Africans. We define it this way. The whites are the citizens and the other people, they're here at our sufferance, right? And to me, the only really sensible argument is to say, all right, well, fine, they may not be citizens, but they're human beings. And how can you treat any human being this way?
Yeah.
And that's the argument where I don't think they would have a very good answer. And in the same way, but once you switch over from arguments about the treatment of citizens to the treatment of human beings, then again, it becomes very hard to defend the immigration restrictions that we've got because, you know, Haitians aren't Americans, but they are human beings. So how can you tell a fellow human being, sorry, you're born in Haiti and you're tough luck, you're stuck there.
Yeah, and especially when you look at, as you do it in the majority of the book, you focus on the economic arguments. And of course, the most common argument, at least that I hear, for restricting immigration is that economic argument, which basically is that, you know, immigrants on the whole cost the United States more than they bring in. So they're a net drain on the economy. And I'm not alone here, right? Even, high priest of sort of free markets, Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize winner, seem to agree with that. In fact, you have a quote from him in the book saying, you cannot simultaneously have free immigration and a welfare state. So Milton Friedman has spoken here, Brian. What do you think about that?
Right. So just at the outset, you want to distinguish between an economic burden and a fiscal burden. And so because, you know, so fiscal burden is basically saying that U.S. taxpayers are going to have to are paying more for services for immigrants than they're getting in taxes. Economic burden would also have to include all of the benefits that the workers bring when they come here. So, I mean, it's quite possible someone could be an economic benefit but a fiscal burden because they produce so much more, but the tax system is still leaves them as a burden. But yes, but to focus on this question with Milton Friedman, here's the thing. I have had many people email me this quote and say, you bet you never thought of that, professor. And I guess I'm familiar with the quote. And the question is it right? And the answer is it's really complicated because obviously you had a welfare state that gave people 10 cents a year. This would not be a very good argument against open borders at all, because it just wouldn't be enough money.
Sure.
On the other hand, if you had one where you give everyone $1 million a year, then it's going to be, then it's clearly going to break the bank. So then where in the real world are we? And this is where I went to the empirical research and tried to not do the corrupt thing of finding people that agree with me. I tried to do a very thorough and balanced review of the literature and relied very heavily on the recent National Academy of Sciences report, where again, it seemed like the people involved were your typical boring non-ideological people. And those are precisely the people you should talk to when you want to get a numerical answer to a question.
Yeah.
All right. And then when you go through the report, there's a multiple different complications, starting with, well, a lot of government spending is what we call non-rival, meaning that the cost doesn't depend upon population. So for example, for national defense, if we had a big baby boom, no one would say we need to get more nukes to defend the babies.
Right.
So, and there's many other things the government does that are like that. And so you want to go and carefully distinguish these the rival from the non-rival kinds of government spending. Then you also want to take into account that a lot of the rival spending is for the old rather than the poor, and immigrants tend to be, especially, immigrants under open borders would tend to be young but poor. So on the one hand, they're eligible for the poverty benefits, but that's not the most important thing the welfare state does anyway by a long shot. So anyway, when people have gone and actually crunched these numbers, Milton Friedman's claim is greatly exaggerated. So really what we can say is that there is a demographic of migrants that are a fiscal burden, and these are basically low-skilled older people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're low-skilled and you're older, then you are likely to be a net burden, but the average right now, not only is the average immigrant to the U.S. a net fiscal gain, but even low-skilled younger immigrants are a fiscal gain, because while they will eventually get those old age benefits, that's a long time in the future. And if you know the basic financial math here, if you can kick a can down the road 40 years, the can shrinks a lot. That's a key fact of finance. Just like you can put money in the bank and it grows for 40 years. Similarly, if I can get you to delay a payment for 40 years, then I don't need to save nearly as much to make the payment.
Well, but I guess one argument kind of pushing back against that would say, well, if not all immigrants are going to be as much of a gain and some might actually be a loss, why don't we instead of having open borders, just say, well, if you're an immigrant with, you know, not a high school education, for instance, you can't come in, but we'll let in people who are going to be more likely to be against. So that would be probably much more open borders, but not as open as I'm guessing you would be in favor of.
Yeah, that's right. So I continue the argument with Milton Friedman in the chapter, and I say, so Milton, would you apply this argument to human reproduction as well?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, should we go and say, well, statistically, most babies will pay for themselves. It's okay for them to be born. But if, according to our actuaries, someone is going to give birth to a child that's going to be a burden on taxpayers, they shouldn't be allowed to have that child.
Yeah.
Right now, Ian, like, this is one where, in terms of the logic, is exactly the same. Right. So you could say you can't have unrestricted reproduction in a welfare state. And well, you say, well, in terms of how big the burden is, it depends on the math. And we need to go and crunch the numbers and see what's going on. But I think also when you put it that way, it does actually engage an extra moral constraint, which is that's a terrible thing to do to a human being. And you shouldn't do it for a light reason. So the fact that someone is going to be a $1,000 fiscal drain on the treasury does not seem to most people to be a reason to say that they aren't allowed to be born. Right. And I say we should apply the same logic to immigrants. And again, while in principle, if someone is going to be an enormous burden, that's where I would say, all right, well, there's a moral principle, but the moral principle isn't absolute. So we should be willing to bend it. But at the same time, we really shouldn't just casually say, well, sorry, you know, you're 56. And according to our calculations, the only people that are a good deal for taxpayers are under 55. It's one where I would say that we should err on the side of letting people in. I would also say that if you are at the point of being concerned and you shouldn't let them in so there's a burden, you should be as well, maybe we should go and change our laws about taxes and redistribution so that they're not a burden anymore rather than saying they can't come.
Yeah, I want to definitely get to that a little more later because you have some very interesting ideas about that. But one thing, when I was reading through the calculations, something that occurred to me is maybe our difficult immigration system creates something of what you might call a selection effect. And what I mean by that is right now, a lot of the people coming to the United States have to overcome some pretty significant barriers. And that might mean that they have more, you know, more pluck, more, they're more industrious than people who don't do that. But if we make it easier to immigrate, then maybe we'd get more people who are less productive. And so those calculations might actually be more optimistic than they turn out to be. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yes, that's a great question. So the way that the numbers are currently done is that they break them down by observable demographic differences. So for example, right now, it's a lot easier to get into the U.S. with an advanced degree than if you're a high school dropout. So those kinds of differences are already factored into the numbers. Now, if you say it's not that it's some observable demographic difference, but rather that we get the best high school dropouts, that's something where it's much harder for the data to actually deal with. However, there's a paper by Michael Clemens and some co-authors where they basically go and explore a lot of scenarios about unobserved differences. So basically the kind of thing where we don't measure it, but we suspect that it's there. And essentially, you have to posit some astronomically large unobservable differences to make much of a dent in these results. Although, you know, so it is plausible, although then there are some questions about how, for example, there are some ways in which we're probably getting negative selection. So, for example, who are the people that are willing to come illegally into the United States? All right. So it could be, for example, that you're getting those that are less law abiding as a result of that. So there could be that kind of negative selection, whereas if it were perfectly legal, then you'd be getting a different result. I mean, probably right now, at minimum, you're getting unattached males at a higher level for illegal immigration. Right? So, and unattached males have a bunch of problems, as we both probably know.
Right?
Right. I'm trying to remember whether it was Reagan or Thatcher who just said that marriage civilizes men.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of crime, young single men do a grossly disproportionate amount of crime, and out of a bunch of other problems, they're really dominating. My guess is that you probably are getting some positive selection, but it's just but once we've adjusted for the observables, then it's a fairly small amount, but.
So,
there is a fundamental problem with saying we've controlled for unobservable stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So normally, the way that researchers do it is they say, all right, fine, we'll just go and explore some scenarios. like how different would they have to be with the Haitian high school dropouts we're getting have to be from the Haitian high school dropouts we're not getting in order for this to be a really bad generalization. And you do have to make some rather extreme assumptions. Okay. But it's a good question.
Yeah. So basically, the upshot is based on what we know is even if it did matter, it probably would just matter a tiny bit at the margins and not enough to. Okay.
Yeah.
Today's episode is sponsored by SaneBox. For years, my email has been, well, sort of a disaster area. Then I gave SaneBox a try, and it utterly transformed my inbox. As your email comes in, SaneBox leaves only the important messages in your inbox and directs all that other distracting stuff to your Sane Later folder. That means you know what messages to pay attention to right now and what can wait. It also has other great features like the Sane Black Hole, where you can drag messages from annoying senders you never want to hear from again, and Sane Reminders, which lets you know if someone hasn't replied to your email by a certain date, which I think is a really useful feature. Best of all, you can use SaneBox with any email client or phone anywhere you check your email. Check out how SaneBox can almost magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Visit SaneBox.com/politicsguys today to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. That's SaneBox.com/politicsguys. Another argument that you hear all the time is a much more, not kind of a broadly economic argument, but much more of a personalized argument saying, well, these people, immigrants, come into this country and take jobs from Americans. And so this is basically helping them, but it's costing citizens or people legally in this country right now jobs.
Right.
And I was wondering what your thought was on that argument.
Yeah. So let me step back and just explain why it is that economists think immigration has economic benefits in the first place.
Yeah, please do.
So it comes down to immigrants normally move because they're moving from a country where their labor produces little, and they go to a country where their labor produces a lot. Now, of course, personally, they just care about money, but the reason why you're getting low wages in Haiti is Haitian workers produce very little. And when they move to Miami, the amazing thing is overnight, really, they start producing a lot more because it's a much more functional economy, right? And what this means is that this enriches the world. Because, you know, this is not the trivial argument that you get more people, you produce more stuff. This is the sophisticated argument that when you move Haitians to the United States, the combined production of Haiti plus the United States goes up and by a lot, right? So, and why? Because you're moving resources from a place where they're doing little to a place where they're doing a lot more. All right. Now, when you go and estimate the full gains of open borders, they normally come out to be enormous. And the reason is that we are taking a regulation that affects a lot of people. You know, we're talking over a billion people. And then we are the average gain to the world production of each person is enormous. You multiply a big number by a big number and you get a huge number. And that is really the heart of the economic case for open borders, is that we're taking a whole lot of wasted human talent, badly wasted human talent, and we're moving it in a way that gets rid of an enormous waste for an enormous number of people. All right, now, when you have all this extra production, it is not going to only go to the migrants themselves because they have to sell it to customers, and so customers wind up sharing a lot of those gains. All right, and now you can see where I'm going here. So when we think about the effect of immigration on a worker, that is only one effect. Right. So when you think about the labor market effect, that's part of the story. You also have to think about the effect on you as a customer, as a consumer. All right. So what I've said many times is that, selfishly speaking, the best immigration policy is open borders for every occupation except mine.
Yeah.
All right. So for me, the very best immigration policy would be academic professors of economics, professors of economics, closed borders, only people born in the United States are allowed to have that job. Every other occupation, totally open borders, because that way the competition in my job is reduced and I can get a great job and I can be at Harvard or whatever, but I can spend my money in an economy bursting with the productivity of all those migrants.
Right.
All right. But then there's the question of, all right, if that's off the table, and of course everyone can't get that deal, right? Right? Everyone can't have the deal of open borders for every occupation but mine. Then there's the question, all right, how about the deal open borders for every occupation, including your own? And that's where I invoke what I say is the fundamental principle of economics. The secret of mass consumption is mass production. If there's a large increase in production, it will be very broadly beneficial. Every rich country is one with a lot of production Every poor country is one with very little production. And we can also see this in previous economic transformations. The Industrial Revolution didn't primarily benefit factory owners. It was very broadly shared. Vaccines didn't primarily benefit the manufacturers of vaccines, broadly shared among all the people who didn't die. The internet, and not something where it's just computer programmers that are benefiting. It's shared among all the consumers. And this is the same thing we should expect for migration. If we can get a large increase in total production by tearing down these walls, then almost everyone is going to gain, not just the migrants, but rather all the people that are consuming those products as well. Right? And if this doesn't make sense to you, would it make sense to you to think that technological progress is bad for us? Because it really is the same idea. Like, well, I mean, a new machine, it puts someone out of work, puts an American out of work. So it does, but it also increases production. And would you rather be in an economy where no one had, where every occupation was protected from technology or where none was? I say, obviously, you want to be in the economy where no occupation is protected from technology, because it means that your country will be rich and your money will buy you a lot of stuff.
So it would basically be, if I understand the argument, kind of a, what you might call Pareto optimal, meaning everyone wins and no one loses, because the gains would be so large that we could essentially compensate the short-term losers, the people who lost their jobs through retraining or other things, and because the gains would be so enormous. Is that kind of what you're...
Well, that's overstated. A lot of economists love to leap to that argument, but I know of no actual major economic change that didn't hurt somebody.
Right.
Right. So the Industrial Revolution, of course, it hurt some people. Right. And the internet hurt some people. Even vaccines hurt some people. Right. There's some doctors who were put out of business or saw their income go down because of vaccines. So, yeah, and you know, driverless cars are going to hurt some people. So there's no change that is so great that it hurts zero people. And even if you start talking about compensating people, well, is everyone going to get compensation or some people going to get missed? What about someone who's elderly and has no kids and then they suffer? So I don't like to overstate. But yes, the fundamental idea of almost everyone wants to live in a rich society, and a society with more immigration will be society where the world is richer and you are very likely to partake in that bounty. That's the argument that I would phrase the argument.
And when you say the world is richer, the number that you had in the book blew my mind. You argue the data shows that open borders could easily double world GDP, which is right around,
yes,
I guess, $75 trillion.
Yes.
That I had a hard time wrapping my head around that. I imagine a lot of listeners would too. Can you kind of put that into a form we can maybe grasp a little more easily?
Yeah, you know, there's a few. So, of course, one is we could just turn back the clock to when global GDP was $37.5 trillion and see, can you believe that we could go from there to here? Of course, it happened, right? There's that. But in the book, I talk about other places that have had migration-fueled growth at a very high level. And the outstanding examples in recent decades are China and India. So, of course, both these countries had market-oriented reforms, and they dialed back socialism quite a bit. A lot of privatization, a lot of deregulation, still plenty of room left for reform. But nevertheless, they did improve a lot. But if the only thing that happened was that you kept the populations where they were, but reduce the regulation, then you'd get quite modest gains. A lot of the reason why China, India got a lot of gain is that they deregulated, and then people in the country were allowed to move to cities.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so both those countries have had migration of hundreds of millions of people from the country to the cities. And when they move to those cities, they wind up building a lot more housing for them and new factories and jobs. And actually, a lot of times, you have a bunch of people moving to a small town, and 20 years later, it's a huge city. That's the story of China and India. And I think, you know, similarly in the United States, when you drive through this country, you'll realize it is a total ghost town. Hardly anything is happening in this country. It's almost totally empty. And would be very easy, actually, to take totally empty areas and build new cities. It'd be very easy to take small, declining towns and build new cities. Detroit could become a city where, instead of losing population, it doubles in population. There is so much room just to go and build. And even in places that are more densely populated, like in Europe, you can still, you know, of course, they still have tons of empty lands. And furthermore, you can always build up, right?
Right.
Which goes to one of my other favorite causes, which is housing deregulation.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard people in Barcelona say, you know, look at our city. We're bounded between the sea and the mountains. There's no way to get bigger. And I say, how about up? Build up. And they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. He goes, oh, yes, of course, we could go up. Right. So, well, and then it's like, well, that would block our view of the cathedral. Oh, come on, people.
Yeah.
Right? Tell you what, let's build a 100-story cathedral for you. Would that improve anything?
You know, you mentioned people moving to cities and areas where there are these opportunities. And so what some people might say is, well, what about these areas that are left behind? And in a way, we're kind of seeing this in the United States, and open borders, I would think, would make this an international problem. And some people would say, aren't we actually doing harm to these other countries with basically open borders would lead to, I would imagine, a massive brain drain and taking all the best and most talented people from these countries and leaving them devastated. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Right. So what I say about brain drain is this. Right now, the brain drain argument is somewhat plausible because it's much easier for brainy immigrants to get in. Right. So right now, if you're a doctor or a PhD, your chances of getting in the United States are not great, but they're pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Right. On the other hand, if you are a farmer in Mexico and you have no close relatives in the United States, your odds of ever getting in legally are pretty much zero. All right. So what open borders does is it opens up immigration to not just the highest skilled workers. It opens up across the board. So I say that whatever brain drain we're getting is largely a function of regulation. And actually, open borders would not only be good for the people that would come, which would be a wide range of people, because farmers like making more money too, but also actually we have good evidence that it would improve the lives of the people left behind because of things like remittances and also just business connections that people get through migration. Probably the best example that we have is 1902. The U.S. Supreme Court illegally opened the border with Puerto Rico. Now, since then, over half of all people of Puerto Rican descent have come to live in the 50 United States. And yet, if you go to Puerto Rico, never mind the hurricane, which no one, as far as I know, blames on immigration or anything. But, you know, that aside, Puerto Rico is virtually the richest place in the entire Caribbean. Right. And this is because of remittances and because Puerto Ricans go to the U.S. to work and then they retire in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rican entrepreneurs make business contacts in the U.S. and then they tie together the people they know in Puerto Rico with the people they know in the U.S. And so actually it has been great for the people who have stayed in Puerto Rico as well for those who have left. By the way, this also gives you an idea about the likely pacing of migration, because when the borders first opened, it was only a few thousand Puerto Ricans who came at first, but it did snowball over time. And I say this is crucial because usually critics of open borders say, look, either billions of people will come and it will just crowd the streets so much the economy will grind to a halt, or people don't want to come and then you won't get these gains because migration will be too low. And I say, look, both of these bad scenarios are wrong. The real scenario is that open borders will lead to growing migration, and over time, we will indeed have over a billion people that will come. But it's not going to happen overnight, which means there's plenty of time to build the housing, create the industries where the immigrants are going to work. So it will be a snowballing rather than either almost none or a sudden avalanche.
Because moving even across town is a big undertaking into another country.
Yes.
Obviously, it's not
right.
Something you can just
yes.
do.
Yes, and a lot of it seems to be that people don't like to be the first person from a country to go to another country.
That makes
right
sense.
Now in the U.S., since we already have some, you know, we have a bunch of immigrant communities, and especially a lot of people in other countries have friends and family here, I think that would be more of a quick wave because there's all this pent-up demand. But I also say that's nothing to worry about. If you've got friends and family here, they're going to help you get on your feet. But then for places where there's hardly any migrants here, those will be the ones where we'll start off as a trickle and then snowball. And so by the time it's a lot, it'll be fine.
Now, another argument that came to me when you were mentioning your China and India examples, and it probably came to me because my wife focuses on, she's a political scientist, she focuses on sustainability. And so I thought about, well, the growth of India and China, I thought, oh my God, they're environmental catastrophes. And so a lot of people would say, do we really want to easily double world GDP if it means, you know, air that's unbreathable and all these other issues? And I wanted to get your thoughts on the environmental consequences of that.
Right. So I guess at the outset, I would say that the people in India and China, I think very few would consider the move from lower pollution and higher income to be a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's, you know, essentially, you know, like, you know, the concern for these environmental effects, a lot of it is something where once you're rich, then it's a big deal to you. But when you're desperately poor, it's very reasonable for them to say, we're just going to put an environment on the back burner. Now, that said, there is actually whole literature on how environmental quality evolves over time with development, and it has a name. It's called the environmental Kuznets curve. Ooh. And what the environmental Kuznets curve says is that when a very poor country starts to develop, then the environment normally gets worse as you start getting air and water pollution from industry, but then it peaks, and then finally you get rich enough where the quality of the environment starts improving a lot. And this really is what we see. It is, by most measures, it's the middle-income countries that are most polluted. The really poor countries, they just don't have enough industry to have any noticeable pollution of the modern kind. But on the other end, the rich countries are also nice and clean. So really what I say is that if you really care about the environment, but you care about it for reasons of human welfare, what you should say is we want to go and zoom through that middle-income period as fast as we can. And open borders is a great way of zooming through that middle-income period because, you know, doing it through normal economic development, I'm optimistic about that, but that just takes a lot longer. The other thing to say about environmental quality is that a lot of this idea that environmental quality gets worse during the early phase of industrialization comes from the specific measures of environmental quality that we use. So if you just start using a measure of, say, automobile emissions in the air, then of course, when you go from no cars to cars, then that measure of the environment gets worse. But there are other things that we don't measure that seem a lot worse. So if you look at the quality of the air in New York City 120 years ago, they've got basically no car exhaust, but they got another kind of unpleasant transportation-related exhaust,
right,
which is horse manure.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, modern environmentalists are not going to be keeping track of horse manure. But at the time, it was a terrible problem in terms of for the same reasons that people don't like modern air pollution. The air smells bad, it's hard to breathe, it creates disease and hurts human health. So this is a case where the introduction of the automobile, it fouled the air with automobile exhaust, but it also pretty much eliminated all horse manure from New York City, other than those little wagons that go around. You still got that. But imagine multiplying that by a factor of 100,000 in New York City.
That's crazy.
I mean, to me, just going around the area around Central Park, it's a little bit annoying to have that horse manure.
And
to imagine having 100,000 times of that, that's where it's like, gee, I don't want to be within 50 miles of this hellhole. Right. And this is true for many other kinds of environmental problems where if we define them only in terms of problems caused by technology, then, of course, initially, at least we get some environmental degradation. But if we cast the net more broadly and include any kind of side effect of human production that is bad for human comfort and well-being, then even this environmental Kuznets curve is, I think, too pessimistic.
Interesting. Let's move on and talk a little bit about culture. I mean, because I think there's this traditionalist story about immigration in the United States that immigrants used to come to the United States and get assimilated. But now it's all, you know, diversity, press one for English, two for Spanish, that sort of thing. And that immigrants are clinging much more to their own cultures and not, you know, American values. And is there, you know, is there much truth to that? And even if there is it something do you think that we should be concerned about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I'd say, anytime you're talking about culture, then it's amorphous. What exactly does someone mean by culture? And so that's why in the book, I try to start with the most easily measured kinds of culture and then gradually move to softer and softer kinds where we really should be more open-minded because it's hard to argue about something where we don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But just starting with linguistic assimilation, here there's very good data going back over 100 years. And what the data says is that today, adult first-generation immigrants rarely become really fluent in English. However, that was also true in the days of Ellis Island.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because when you're an adult, learning a new language to the point of fluency is really hard.
Yeah.
However, for second-generation immigrants today and in the Ellis Island days, in both cases, they acquire near-total fluency. All right, so that's one measure where we can say that we see something very similar. And then, you know, why does it seem different? There's a pretty simple explanation for this, which is that in the past, usually there would be a wave of immigration from a non-English-speaking country, and then it would stop. And then after two generations, every person of that identity would speak English. So, for example, for German immigration, you have a period where you got German immigrants, and then German immigration almost totally stops. And so now virtually everyone of German descent in the U.S. speaks English and probably doesn't speak German. All right. On the other hand, for Spanish-speaking immigration, we've just had many waves of it. So it continues. So there's always a new first generation group of Spanish speakers to create the illusion that Spanish speaking cultures don't learn English. There is one difference between Spanish speaking migrants and others, which is that Spanish speakers retain Spanish for an extra generation. Whereas when you look at almost every other migrant group to the US, they just lose it. But the second generation isn't very good anymore. Second generation Koreans don't speak good Korean. Third generation ones seem to not speak it at all, pretty much. So there is that.
And as you point out in the book, it's easier for people to stay in touch with wherever they came from due to technology as well.
Yes. Yeah, so there are some reasons why assimilation is less likely than it used to be. Namely, a modern communications technology and transportation make it easier to not assimilate. But on the other hand, the fact that we have modern transportation and communication has caused a great cultural blanketing of the world with Western and especially American culture. So now we have a very large number, over 1 billion people that are what I call pre-assimilated. So the people who are in a non-English speaking country, but they still know a lot about the United States and they speak English very well. So, you know, and I was saying, you know, compared to 1900, Sicilian immigrants probably never heard English spoken. He's a rural Sicilian, let's say. Never heard English spoken, maybe never seen electricity. That guy shows up in Ellis Island, that's real culture shock.
Yeah.
Today, you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in Italy that had not heard some English, probably they're going to speak, you know, at least some English. And the same holds true all over the world. There is just this great group of people that are ready to hit the ground running because modern communication and transportation are two-way streets. It makes it easier to not assimilate once you're here, but it also makes it much easier to assimilate before you even contemplate coming.
And in fact, as you point out in the book, there are plenty of countries who are actually concerned about the dominance of American culture so that they actually have regulations in place so that American culture can't dominate their own culture too much.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you'll have, you know, small things like Canadian content regulations, but I think I can't remember if I mentioned the Ayatollah Khomeini had a word that he used, and he called it West Toxification. West Toxification.
Oh,
right? And he's saying, look, all this Western country is pouring into our country and it's destroying our culture. And he didn't say, let's have a free market. No, he said, we need to use the force of government to crush this.
Right.
And what I say is that there is cultural competition. And whenever there's a level playing field around the world, Western culture does really well.
Yeah, definitely.
That's why, you know, even in countries that you think of as very hostile to Western culture, if Saudi Arabia were to just tear down the walls and say, you can sell whatever Western culture you want to here, Saudi Arabia would be unrecognizable in 10 years.
Yeah.
Because you're living in a totalitarian fundamentalist state doesn't mean that you don't want to watch international movies and look at pornography and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little doubt that the people in Saudi Arabia, a lot of them would love to go and get access to Western culture. So of course there's other people who want to stop them, but in a free market where you have to actually win people's dollars by persuasion, Western culture would do very well. And really a lot of what immigration is it's voting with your feet for a different culture.
Now, there's also the question of crime and terrorism. And of course, you know, President Trump famously talked about, you know, wanting to make sure there are walls so we don't let bad hombres in from Central America. And, you know, there are a lot of people who feel that if we open up our borders, we're also opening up our doors to people who would like to destroy Western democracy. And so what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it's not totally wrong. So I think that there would be more terrorism in an open borders world. So I just want to be honest about that. Mm-hmm. What I say in the book is that this is statistically such a tiny problem. We can multiply it by a factor of 10 and it would remain a tiny problem. So I know this is a very unpopular view, but I'm very influenced. There's a book by a political scientist, John Mueller, called Overblown, where he just goes over the numbers on this. Terrorism is statistically one of the smallest dangers on Earth, and yet there have been very costly crusades to go and fight against it. And I'm not saying that it's not a problem, but I'm saying it's just one problem among many. And the idea that this should be a priority of national policy just seems very odd to me. Now, makes much more sense in my view to focus on crime in general because terrorism is just dwarfed by just normal crime. And then here what we can say is, at least for the United States, that we've got reasonably good data, and it says that the foreign-born have lower rates of crime than natives in the United States. This is probably not true for Europe, from what I've seen. And the explanation seems pretty simple. It comes down to this. Native-born Americans have really high crime. Native-born Europeans have really low crime. Immigrants are somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're worse than Europeans, but they're better than us.
Right.
That's anyway, what I tell Europeans is, all right, trying, it's true, they're more criminally inclined than you, but that's because you guys are so law-abiding, crime is not a very serious problem in Europe. Whereas in America, actually, it's quite a bit more serious, actually, especially for really, really, really severe violent crime. And what I can say is that immigrants are not as bad or less bad than us. So unless you think that the birth of a native-born American is bad because of his statistical crime propensity, say it doesn't make sense to keep immigrants out on these grounds. Although, again, in terms of, you know, if you've got someone where you've actually got specific evidence that he's planning a crime or is statistically very likely to commit a crime, then I wouldn't consider it a big deal to keep that person out. But to use it as an excuse for keeping out immigrants in general doesn't seem very solid.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that other countries could use our open borders against us? You know, I thought about the Mariel boat lift in 1980 in Cuba, where Castro opened the doors of the prisons, right? And that's the idea. And of course, it makes me think about the movie Scarface. That's all another story. but I mean, is that, you know, I could see someone like Kim Jong-un saying, "Oh, this is great. We can, you know, send these undesirables to America and let them be their problem." Is that one of those things that's overblown as well, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, definitely for North Korea, I would love to get all their undesirables, right? I mean, so most of those people are totally innocent victims.
Yeah, political prisoners, sure.
Totalitarian oppressor. And, you know, just like with Cuba as well. So, yeah, he let out a lot of prisoners, but most of the people who came are just regular innocent people. So, I mean, like, you know, is it logically possible that they could just send over their ex-murderers? It is, but I don't see this as a very serious problem. I was talking with someone about, do we really want to get China's Uyghurs? I don't know why they're in prisons, but until I know. And I said, yes, send us the Uyghurs, right? You know, these people are almost all totally innocent, just being sent into these horrible slave labor camps. And it would be not just a good deed, but we would also be, you know, showing that we actually mean what we say, and that when someone is a victim of totalitarian oppression, you know, there is a place for them on Earth where they'll be treated like human beings.
Now, there are also, though, some domestic political considerations. It seems to me, and to a lot of people, that Republicans have really some pretty good electoral reasons to oppose open borders, right?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So here I'd say we should really distinguish between short-term and long-term.
Mm-hmm.
So in the short-term, it makes a lot of sense for Republicans, especially, well, particularly if you are a Republican politician. So what really matters to you is getting that job. All right. Because, you know, right now, immigrants have very low rates of voting for Republicans. Immigrants have become highly Democratic. But here's what's striking to me. I went back in the data. In the 1980s, this was not true.
Hmm.
In the 1980s, this was not true. Reagan did about as well as Democrats did with foreign-born voters. And so it doesn't seem that there's any sense in which immigrants are fundamentally Republican or Democratic. It seems rather that it's something that is a contingent fact that's happened in recent decades. And once you start thinking that way, the obvious story to me is that immigrants have lost the Republican, or Republicans have lost the immigrant vote because they have started viewing immigrants as the enemy. And of course, there's a spiral here where Republicans get skeptical of immigrants get skeptical of Republicans, which makes Republicans more skeptical of immigrants. So I see this is a lot of what has gone on. And then I would say that if you're worried about the long-run prospects of your party, unless you think you could really turn back the clock and just get the foreign-born percentage of the U.S. down and see no sign that Trump is going to be able to pull this off, in that case, you know, I guess maybe like it did peak, but anyway, it doesn't seem like it's likely to be a long stable in the long run. Then you could either continue fight this desperate battle to keep immigrants out, but alienating the whole foreign-born population, or most of them, or you could go and do political entrepreneurship and reach out to people that don't vote for you yet.
Yeah, because it actually seems to me that, and I know a number of Republicans have made this argument, not so much now, but certainly in the past, that on a lot of cultural issues, A lot of immigrants seem to be more inclined to support Republicans. And really, the big issue that's stopping a lot of immigrants from voting Republicans is that Republicans want to limit immigration.
Yes. And also, I think even more so than the policy is just treating them disrespectfully.
Mm-hmm.
right? And acting like they're not full Americans, that kind of thing, that tends to really turn people off.
Sure.
So, I mean, you know, but just, you know, example. So in 1960, the idea that you could get Catholics voting Republican would have just seemed like a pipe dream.
Yeah.
And the short term, it was a pipe dream, but it happened, right? And it happened because there were some entrepreneurial Republicans who said, Democrats or, you know, Catholics don't vote for Republicans yet. And they changed their pitch and reached out. And again, a lot of it is just at a personal level of just being nice to people and talking to them and trying to show that you respect them and appreciate them. So I think that's a lot of what the future of the Republican Party will be, if it has a future, is saying, look, well, we've got a whole lot of people that are immigrants here and children of immigrants, and we're not going to be able to keep power if we keep treating them like the enemy. We've got to somehow win them over. Right. And you know, my favorite particular example of this right now is, I say Republicans should push forward a total open doors policy for Venezuela.
Oh,
and say,
wow, okay,
look, Venezuelans are victims of a horrible socialist tyranny.
Ooh.
This is, and anyone who wants out of Venezuela, we want them here. We will welcome them. And even with the underlining idea, we're going to turn Venezuelans into the next Cubans. This is going to be a solidly Republican group. Now you might say, well, are they solid Republican? And again, the question is, well, that depends upon what we do. If we, you know, if you've got local Republican parties ready there to meet them at the airports with fruit, with baskets, and helping them to go and find jobs and apartments and really taking them under their wing, then I think it's totally reasonable to think in 10 years you will have Venezuelan congressmen, Venezuelan American congressmen saying, you know, do not speak to me of socialism. I have lived under this socialist hell.
Right, yeah,
anything
yeah.
I can do for my new country to protect it from this, you know, horrible, terrible tyranny.
Right.
I will die. So if you could get some like that,
sure. Yeah,
right. So someone who's, you know, like who actually can speak from firsthand experience and say, you're just a bunch of ignorant children when you talk about socialism. I lived it. I saw it destroy my country, and now I'm really happy to be here, and I don't want you to mess things up, and you don't know what you're talking about. You know, if you can imagine that being part of the Republican Party, that's the kind of thing that an entrepreneurial Republican, I think, would be trying to make happen. And again, those who say that's just wishful thinking, it's not wishful thinking. Maybe it's hard, but winners try to do hard things.
Yeah. And you mentioned you actually have a number of interesting solutions to some of these problems. You call them keyhole solutions.
Solutions.
So maybe you could first talk about what that term keyhole solution means.
Right. Yeah. So back in the old days, surgeons did some horrific things to people without worrying very much about the chance the surgery itself might kill the victim or otherwise mess up their lives after the surgery. But, so your Civil War amputations, that kind of thing. But in recent decades, surgery has advanced, and there is now a very standard idea of what they'll call keyhole surgery. This is where you do the smallest incision that you need to do the job, so that, and then you use your special cameras to get in there. And basically, you just try to go and fix problems without creating other problems. You try to deal with, you try to handle surgery in a way where you are minimizing collateral damage. All right. Now, economic journalist Tim Harford really liked this idea, and he said, and we should think about economic policy the same way, really all public policy.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot, there's a lot of social problems out there, and we have a lot of policies that are designed to solve these problems, but the policies are very crude and ignore collateral damage to a large extent. And he said, why don't we then go and take a lesson from surgery and try to design what he called keyhole solutions or keyhole policies, where you try to solve a problem in the cheapest and most humane way that you possibly can. You know, for example, if you're worried about air pollution, you could either write a phone book of regulations, which is a very costly way of solving the problem, or you could tax pollution,
right,
which is the kind of thing that economists have generally favored and say, yeah, you can pollute all you want, but you have to pay the certain amount for it. And in this way, we can get the same level of air cleanliness at a much lower cost. All right. And then in this book, I apply Open Borders, I apply this idea to complaints about immigration. And this is a chapter where I just say, okay, well, I probably haven't totally convinced you that everything is fine about immigration, but let's just go and take your complaints at face value and then try to engineer a cheap, humane remedy for your problem other than just saying that immigrants can't come.
And I love that part of the book, because when you got that, I forget exactly how you word it, but basically say, let's just assume everything that you think that I've proven is wrong about immigration is right. Mm-hmm. Here are still some good solutions. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. And one of these solutions you mentioned is restricting immigrants' access or eligibility for government services. And now a lot of people say, well, wait a second, that seems unfair.
Right. And what I say is, you know, it seems kind of unfair to me too, but it's a lot less unfair than saying you can't come at all.
Yeah.
And that's the status quo. So people are very quick to say, oh, that's absolutely unconscionable. You know, unlike letting someone starve to death and hate, that's conscionable. But it's not unconscionable to say they can come to Miami, but they have to wait 5 years in order to get welfare benefits. So to me, there is just a bizarre morality behind those objections. And so anyhow, as terms of what is and isn't fair, I just say it's just a lot more complicated than people think. In the case of eligibility for government benefits, what I say is, well, it is true that a lot of immigrants are, at least some immigrants would be using more services than they're paying taxes. So why not just go and fix that so that we can eliminate this complaint? Maria, partly when I was doing the chapter on fiscal effects, every time I heard people talking about a new government program, I was saying, oh, that's going to ruin the math. You know, so someone says free college for all, and I said, look, have you thought about how this is going to mess up the math for the fiscal effects of immigration?
Yeah.
Don't do that. You know, so it does give you that perspective on it. But any other, there's many different ways you could do it. You could just say you have to pay a certain amount of taxes before you become eligible, or there's a waiting period, a lot of different ones. And then I also say, when people say this is terrible, or alternately that it's a pipe dream, it'll never happen, I say it already exists.
Yeah.
We already have a lot of limits on what benefits immigrants are allowed to receive. You know, if you're a tourist, you can only get emergency care. If you're a legal immigrant, then there's a lot of benefits restricted for the first 5 years. So given that this already exists, first of all, to say that it's absolute evil is pretty silly. Like, you weren't saying it was absolute evil before I talked about it.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's all to say that it's not doable is silly when it exists.
Now, if we did this, presumably part of open borders would also be recognizing or legalizing in some way the people that are currently undocumented in this country. And that's somewhere between like 10.5 and 12 million people. And unlike open borders where people would trickle in, maybe not trickle, but you get the idea, that would be a lot of people all at once. And I was wondering what the effects of that would be.
Right. I would say that's not a lot of people. That's less than 3%, or really, I guess about 3% of the U.S. population. So, and here's the thing, they're already here. Like, almost all of them already have jobs and a place to live. So I just don't see that being much of an issue at all, honestly. I mean, in a way, you know, they're already integrated into the U.S. economy. The main effect is just going to be that a lot of them will be able to come out of the shadows and get better jobs for themselves.
And I guess they would also be taxpayers at that point, so maybe they'd actually be paying more into the system, so it'd be more of a benefit.
Yeah, it's complicated because a lot of times an illegal immigrant still has a legal job, and then they do pay taxes, but on a fake Social Security number, that kind of thing. And also, it's probably true that a lot of people that are currently here illegally would bring their families. And so a lot of the benefit of just having a population of single workers, that will go and mess that up a bit. But still, I think that overall that would be a great thing. And by the way, of course, this is one of the few things in the book that's probably already popular, right? Is legalizing illegal immigrants that are already here. Even some very anti-immigration people, like Mark Akorian of the Center for Immigration Studies, has said, well, his ideal would be a deal where we drastically slash legal immigrations, greatly increase border enforcement, and then legalize at least younger illegal immigrants.
And that there definitely is a lot of bipartisan support for that. But on the assimilation issue, some people would say, well, wait a second, before we do anything like this, take a look at the EU and take a look at the whole Brexit thing. And it sure does look like Europe's got some pretty big assimilation issues, and they're all open bordery with the EU and that. And maybe that should be a caution for us.
Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time in Europe, and I'll just say there is, as usual, an enormous disconnect between the news and reality.
Okay.
So, of course, there's an old saying that if any time that you actually know firsthand about a news story and then you see what the coverage is, you'll notice that there's some problems.
Oh, yeah.
But like the fundamental problem is, what does the news do? Is they try to get shocking, emotionally affecting stories to sell whatever, to get eyeballs. That's the standard recipe for news everywhere. And so you can live in a town where it's virtually crime-free, but if there's one bad thing that happens, that's a huge story. And then people start talking about how there's a horrible crime problem in your town, right? Or Here's one that, well, that to me is pretty funny as a professor anyway. I've heard people, a story saying, like, you know, today's millennials, their parents are calling professors all the time in order to go and lobby for their kids.
Never happened to me.
Over 20 years, I've never had a parent call me for this.
Yeah.
But it's just, but you know, a story about how parents just will let their kids figure things out for themselves and barely anything's changed. That's not a story. Whereas, talk to a professor who has parents going and yelling at them. That's a story.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I say, you know, this explains why we're so worked up over terrorism. It's not because it's a quantitatively serious problem. It's barely a problem at all, but it is super emotionally affecting. It's a fantastic chance to tell a tale.
Yeah.
That's why there are also so many movies about terrorism. That's why you have 8 seasons of the show 24. All fictional, of course, but people watched it because it's a great story. Of this hero fighting these terrorists who are ready to unleash Armageddon, right? And this is my view about Europe as well. There are so many news stories about lack of assimilation and things are decaying and there's going to be the death of Europe, on and on. I have gone through the areas of Europe where people say they have been destroyed by immigration and I have no idea what people are talking about. They're crazy, right? So, I mean, I've been through Malmö, Sweden. It looks better than a whole lot of places in the United States, right? And when people say, you know, like, so I haven't been to Molenbeek, but Tyler has, and he's like, I just don't know what you're talking about. But however, of course, if you were a journalist, you could go there and you could find some horrible people there and say, I interviewed some supporters of ISIS here in Molenbeek, and then there they are. And you know, they're selling fruit by day, but by night they're on the ISIS websites trying to get the money to go volunteer in Syria. All right. And that's a story that terrifies people, but it would not be hard to do something similar for the United States.
Sure.
Right. And what I'll say is I've been over many of the countries in Europe where people have said that there's a terrible problem with assimilation. And I just look around and I say, I don't know what you're talking about. I can see someone saying there's a minor problem.
Right.
But here's the thing is, anyone who complains says it's terrible. Whereas I will say, right, so maybe they got lower labor force participation than natives in Sweden, for example. All right. Seems to be true. All right. But when someone says, look, immigrants just don't work in Sweden. That's where I say, look, you're obviously wrong. The guy that sold me a ticket at the Swedish train station was obviously from Africa. And so what you said is false.
Right.
And that's where, okay, well, look, I didn't really mean none. I meant that it's low. All right, first of all, say what you mean.
Yeah.
Because this is already an emotional enough issue. So we don't have to deal with people just making things up. But then I say, look, you know, if it really were true that zero immigrants in Sweden were working, then you'd say, wow, this is a really intractable problem. We've got a kind of human being that does not work. On the other hand, if it's just a matter of their labor force participation is 10 or 20 percentage points below that of native-born Swedes, this is where I say, okay, now let's go and try to figure out what's going wrong and try to go and tweak incentives in order to go and change that. And again, maybe this means that we need to go and restrict welfare benefits for refugees, for example, and say you don't get them for as long as you currently do. Maybe, of course, it means that we need to look at regulations that we have that make it hard for an immigrant to get a job.
Right.
So often in countries where people are complaining about refugees not working, if you look at the law, it's illegal for them to work. So then it's no big puzzle as to why they're not working. They don't want to get deported for breaking the law.
Sure. Yeah. Now, I look at recent history, at least, and, you know, I obviously hear what President Trump, who's sort of the standard bearer for restricting a lot of types of immigration. And I guess a lot of people would see that and find it hard to be optimistic about the future of immigration policy if they're more open borders oriented. So I wanted to ask you, how optimistic are you about the future of immigration policy?
So I'm mildly optimistic, and for the following reason. We've got data on people Americans use in immigration policy. And what it says is that for about 30 or 40 years, less than 10% of Americans favored more immigration. And then in the last 15 or 20 years, that has gone from under 10 to about 30. So there's been roughly a tripling, maybe even a quadrupling of support for more. Now, it's still a minority position, but it basically went from being a deviant, bizarre position to being a common one. And if you just go and compare it to a few other success stories or at least social change stories, it looks very much like the public opinion for marijuana legalization and for gay marriage.
Gotcha.
Both of which were also stuck at very low levels for decades and then suddenly took off. and became majority positions, and then have now those other two have virtually won. Now, open border, you know, so of course what I favor is not more immigration, but open borders. And so that's why I'm only mildly optimistic. I think that if Trump was going to succeed, he would have succeeded in his first 2 years.
Yep.
Right. So, and in particular, now you may say, haven't there been horrible changes in immigration policy? What I'll say is there have been bad executive decisions, but there's been no change in U.S. immigration
law. Right. Yeah, it's a good point.
And that's what I was worried about, is that he would achieve a fundamental change in U.S. immigration law during his first 2 years. And he tried to get that and he failed. Right. And since then, there's been, see, I would say that there's no prospect that he's going to be able to get any change in fundamental U.S. immigration law. So whatever bad executive orders he's given, they will be reversed quite plausibly under the next Republican, never mind the next Democrats, because he really was someone, he really, really, it really is an outlier in terms of views, I think.
Yeah, and so, it definitely.
Right. You know, there is this view that there's been a Trumpification of the Republican Party, so now whoever succeeds him will be just like him. I can believe there's been some moderate Trumpification, but I really doubt the next person will be even half, will move even half of the way between what was normal before and him, because he's so abnormal.
Right, and it seems like there's also a lot of pressure from the business community for more immigration for a number of reasons, and that will be hard to politically resist, I would think.
Yeah, you know, quite right. So, and you know, and whenever I'm talking to someone who's really upset about business influence on policy, I always say, well, what about business influence on immigration? Right? You know, so it really probably is true that pro-business Republicans were the marginal factor that prevented a large restriction of legal immigration under Trump.
So I like a lot of what you have to say, but philosophically, as listeners know, I'm a Burkean, which means that huge, quick changes, especially when they're not organic, that's something I'm very uncomfortable with. And so it seems to me that a better approach would be not necessarily to just throw open the borders, but to slowly expand immigration, to sort of see what happens, measure, you know, the consequences, both intended, and we know there'll be some unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And then proceed from there kind of step by step. And I was wondering what you thought about that sort of incrementalist approach to things.
Yeah. So I just, first of all, say your instinct makes perfect sense to me. So I spend a lot of time reading history, and I will say that most radical ideas end in total disaster.
Yeah.
And then the question is, do they end in total disaster because radical ideas are generally bad, or do they end in disaster because the people that implemented them didn't do their homework? I'm very much in the didn't do their homework camp. So I don't think the problem with socialism is that it was radical. I think the problem was that the people that were radical socialists just were totally dogmatic fanatics who knew nothing about economics or the world. And then they seize power and use fire and blood to impose their delusions upon society with the predictable results.
Yeah.
So I would say that there's always a burden on anyone pushing radical change to do their homework and say, look, like, have you act like, what experience do we have? Let's look at the arguments, listen to them. I'd say that if in the 19th century, if the socialists had just very carefully listened to all the critics, they never would have done what they had done, because the critics had great points, which were very easy to see once the socialists gained power after saying, oh, that's just bourgeois nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And then they get power and they, oh yeah, because there's an incentive problem. Oh. Just like those bourgeois economists said. Right? My view is, you know, do your homework. And this book is part of trying to do my homework. So I don't want to be an irresponsible radical. I want to be a scrupulous radical who really listens to the critics and makes a serious effort to say, all right, what are all the complaints people have made? What are all the worries that people have? And are they reasonable? But the other thing I would say is that even most Burkeans have some radical changes that they actually do think were justified. So sure. My guess is that a quick abolition of slavery, well, is in your view, was actually justified.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, remember, I don't, you know, Abraham Lincoln was very Burkean about slavery. He said we should get rid of it over 100 years.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that you can be a reasonable Burkean while saying there's some policies of government are so heinous, and the evidence in favor of getting rid of them is so solid that it's okay to move fast on those occasions.
Right.
Right. Right. And now, I mean, even in the case of slavery, I would say, well, what if we have to have a really bloody war to do it, then maybe it would be okay to go and delay it, slow it down a bit. Right. Nevertheless, yeah. Or, you know, or another one I say, you know, the end of communism would have been better to have dragged the collapse of communism out over 30 years. Right. And right. I think it was really good that it happened over three
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
Right. And I say this knowing that there were large declines in GDP and other problems and that Putin came out of it. But even at all of that, when you know how horrible it was before, then, yeah. you know, then a prudent Burkean would still say, tear down the wall, burn communism, because this system is totally and irredeemably evil. And this is a case where radicalism is justified. And of course, it's one where people have been doing their homework about how bad is the system for a long time. So, I would say that the historical experience has totally borne out the radical critics. And, you know, for example, despite its bad name, I think shock therapy was not only good, but it should have been much shockier than it was. Because, you know, when you look at the ex-communist countries 30 years later, you'll see the ones that reformed the most have done the best. And the ones that were there saying, let's take it really slow, like Belarus, they barely reformed at all. Right. So I say that, you know, it's important for even for a good Burkean to, first of all, appreciate there's something so bad that radical change is justified. And also to realize that there's some changes where it is like ripping off a Band-Aid, where if you give people time to decide whether they really want to do it, it's likely to never happen, or at least you'll have to wait decades. So
that's a great point.
Yeah. So and that's where I see open borders. This is not just a minor problem. This is something that's greatly impoverishing mankind. It is causing great misery on Earth, right? And it's one where we have where the research is, to me, seems very solid that the complaints are just at best overblown. And really, I just say most of the arguments against immigration are missing the big picture of this tragic and terrible waste of human talent that we are currently just accepting as normal because we haven't known anything else for so long.
And the book does such a great job of really highlighting that in an eye-opening way. And so, again, Brian Kaplan, it's been a pleasure, as always, talking to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Awesome talking to you, Michael.
That's it for today's show. Thanks for listening. We hope you like what you heard. Listener support is what keeps us going, and as a monthly sustaining supporter of the show on Patreon, you get special bonus content, completely ad-free episodes, and more. To become a supporter, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can get in touch with us at mail@politicsguys.com. And for more great discussions, check out our Bipartisan Politics subreddit. The URL's in the show notes. We've also got a Facebook page where we post stuff all the time. That's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And finally, we are on Twitter @politicsguys. We'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the show, leave ratings and reviews, and most especially, share your favorite episodes on social media or email if you're old school. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Andra Masker, and Daniel Toe. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. Our opening theme is Rollin' at 5 by Kevin MacLeod. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.